So this is the 73rd sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, the Maha Vachagota Sutta. And this particular man, this man called Vachagota, he is actually a fellow who recurs a lot in the suttas. You see him in many different places. He always comes to the Buddha and he asks him questions about all sorts of things, all kind of metaphysical points and all kind of stuff. So he basically asks all these questions over a long period of time. And eventually he comes to the point where he decides to ordain. And that happens in this sutta here. And after he ordains, he must have had some very good karma or good foundations for the practice, because then he becomes an arahant very quickly after that. So it's quite nice in a sense. Somebody who keeps on pushing and asking questions until one day he decides to ordain and becomes an arahant. It's quite a nice story. Anyway, so this is what happens in this particular sutta. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary here. Then the wanderer Vachagota went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One. Yeah. By the way, if anybody has any questions at any stage, please raise your hand and we can maybe take it as we go along here, so it becomes a bit more like a discussion, if you like. Yeah. So he said to the Blessed One, I have had conversations with Master Gotama for a long time. It would be good if Master Gotama would teach me in brief the wholesome and the unwholesome. I can teach you the wholesome and the unwholesome in brief, Vacha. I can teach you the wholesome and the unwholesome at length. Still, I will teach you the wholesome and the unwholesome in brief. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, he replied, and the Blessed One said this. So first of all, just here the distinction is made between the wholesome and the unwholesome. What does it mean in Buddhism when we talk about wholesome and unwholesome? And essentially, something is wholesome or something is unwholesome, it depends on the result it gives for you. So if something is productive of future happiness, then it's wholesome by definition. If something is productive of future suffering, then it is unwholesome. That's how it's defined. There is no kind of absolute standard. It is the result that it produces for you which decides whether something is wholesome or unwholesome. So, yes, sir, he replied, the Blessed One said this, Vacha, greed is unwholesome. Non-greed is wholesome. Hate is unwholesome. Non-hate is wholesome. Delusion is unwholesome. Non-delusion is wholesome. In this way, three things are unwholesome, and the other three things are unwholesome. So these things here are often also called, these things are often called the roots of karma, the roots of action. And as a root of action, they actually mean the motivation that lies behind an action. This is what drives the action. And it is the motivation behind the action, what actually drives the action to happen. That is what decides whether something is bad karma or good karma. In other words, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. So there's three negative or unwholesome roots or motivations, and then there's three wholesome motivations that lie behind any action you do, whether it's action by mind, speech, or body. These actions, of course, it's not just that one is wholesome, another one is wholesome. There's a whole scale here of variation between how wholesome it is or how unwholesome it is. It can be extremely unwholesome if there's lots of hatred, for example, together with very bad actions like murder or whatever. And it can be only slightly unwholesome if you are irritated with somebody, but you don't actually take any kind of action in return. You don't say anything or you don't do anything yet. So it's a very, very broad scale here of unwholesome and unwholesome. Greed here, greed refers basically to sensual desire. So any kind of sensual desire comes under greed. Hate is the whole scale from the mildest irritation to the strongest kind of rage. And delusion is the most difficult one to understand here, because Delusion in the suttas, this word is moha in the Pali language, is often used more or less synonymously with avidya. This word avidya, you may have heard, is often translated as ignorance in the suttas. And it always means the sense that you don't understand the Four Noble Truths. You don't understand the idea of non-self, of suffering, and of impermanence. You don't see things as it actually is. So avidya is a very profound kind of lack of understanding. In fact, ignorance might be wrong, because ignorance gives this idea that you don't know something. It's not actually about not knowing something, but not understanding something or seeing something clearly. That's the problem really here. So that is avidya. Avidya is like this deep lack of understanding. And it's all, avidya only gets turned around when you become a stream enter. For the first time, that's when your view becomes rectified. And then eventually when you become an arahant, that is when avidya becomes, when you abandon avidya completely once and for all. But you can see here that moha, delusion, well, it's possible to have non-delusions. Non-delusion is wholesome. And obviously it's possible to make good karma. So what this means, that it must mean that it's possible to have non-delusion even though you're not an Arya, even though you haven't penetrated the Four Noble Truths, it's still possible to have non-delusion. So this is a much more, it's a broader principle than avidya, this idea of moha. It's much broader. So you can say you have some moha, some delusion, even if you are just very confused. Or if you have wrong view about something, you think that, oh, I can go around, do all kind of bad things, not going to have anything, nothing is going to happen to me because of that. These kind of things is already moha. But if you have a view which is, you understand the consequences of bad action, you understand that these things are not advisable, neither for yourself nor for others, and you have a clear mind, then that is what lack of moha means in this particular case. So it's more flexible principle than avidya, as I understand it. And that's why it is possible to have non-delusion and yet still not be a stream entry, not having seen the Dhamma for yourself. Does that make sense, what I'm saying? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this is these are the three then roots of bad and good actions, three opposites. So then the Buddha goes into greater detail about these roots, about what is unwholesome. So he then goes on, killing living beings is unwholesome. Abstention from killing living beings is wholesome. Taking what is not given is unwholesome. Abstention from taking what is not given is wholesome. Misconduct in sensual pleasures is unwholesome. Abstention from misconduct in sensual pleasures is wholesome. False speech is unwholesome. Abstention from false speech is wholesome. Malicious speech is unwholesome. Abstention from malicious speech is wholesome. Harsh speech is unwholesome. Abstention from harsh speech is unwholesome. Gossip is unwholesome. Abstention from gossip is wholesome. Covetousness is unwholesome. Uncovetousness is wholesome. Ill will is unwholesome. Non-ill will is wholesome. Wrong view is unwholesome. Right view is wholesome. In this way, 10 things are unwholesome, and the other 10 things are wholesome. Okay, so I'm going to go through this in a bit more detail, because just to make it a bit more clear, maybe some of these things. So these things that you see in this sutta here, these are normally called the 10 courses of action, or the 10 ways of action. And there are 10 unwholesome ways of action. And then you have the opposite, the 10 wholesome ways of action. And here you can see you have both all the way through here. One thing which is good to be aware of here, it says that killing living beings is unwholesome. Abstention from killing living beings is wholesome. In other places, it also not only says that, it's not just that the abstention is wholesome, but very often the suttas talk about doing the opposite. In other words, having compassion, laying aside all kind of violence and intimidation of beings, and having compassion towards living beings, seeing living beings with a kindly eye, being nice, doing the opposite of killing living beings and frightening them. And this is true for this whole list. Not only is it the abstention itself that you try to avoid, but you actually try to encourage the opposite act, the positive act, the good act. And that's an important principle of Dhamma, of course, which sometimes is not talked about so much, because the suttas have a tendency to talk about greed and non-greed, rather than saying greed, for example, and generosity. Hate and non-hate could rather be hate and loving-kindness, for example. Okay, so the first one here of these 10 ways, killing living beings is unwholesome. Abstention from killing living beings is wholesome. Now you may have noted that in the paragraph just before, the Buddha says that non-hate is wholesome, non-delusion is wholesome, non-greed is unwholesome. So what happens if you kill a living being, but you do it because of non-greed, non-hate and non-delusion? Do you see what I mean there? The point I'm trying to make here is that these two categories could potentially be contradictory here. You could do the right thing according to one paragraph and the wrong thing according to the following paragraph. And the way I understand that the way I think you should understand this is that killing living beings, by definition, is understood that you have an unwholesome root, an unwholesome motivation when you do that. If you do kill a living being without an unwholesome motivation, you have a wholesome motivation instead, it doesn't really count as killing anymore. And that's why I think in this particular case, you can say that if you are able to, for example, of course, a classical example is always euthanasia. When somebody performs euthanasia, if it really comes from compassion, if it comes from understanding, it comes from wisdom, then I would say it might not come under killing in this particular case. So it is important always when we see a list like this, it's always important to remember that a list is just a list, and a list is never going to be absolutely comprehensive as to what is good and what is bad. Usually you have to go back to the quality of mind, the intention behind it, to understand whether something is good karma or bad karma. That is the kind of the ultimate guide as to whether something is unwholesome and wholesome. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah. That's true. Yeah. No, it's true. The reason for that, I think, is because the monk's vinaya, and I think this might be true for the nuns as well, the vinaya is often very, because it's a legalistic thing, yeah, it's often very, you can't actually use that to decide what is good karma and bad karma, because the vinaya is like a legalistic document, and it takes very, it doesn't really take into account the finer refinements of things. Yeah. If it fulfills certain categories according to the vinaya, then it's parajika no matter what. And that's the problem. I would agree with you. It may not have been very bad karma from the monk's point of view, but because somehow it fulfilled those categories for being parajika, then he actually was parajika. So there's not much flexibility in the vinaya, and that's why you have to be very clear and very careful as to what you do in vinaya matters. And if I were, this is why a monk cannot actually recommend euthanasia outright, and then somebody follows that recommendation, then you actually would be parajika. So all I can say as a monk is I can say, the reality is I don't actually know whether these things are wholesome or unwholesome. That's the truth of it. I can't really tell. All I can say is that the more wholesome are the roots or the motivation for the action, the more wholesome they are, the less bad karma there's going to be. And I can sort of envisage the possibility that even with euthanasia, you might be able to come from pure compassion. If you are, there wouldn't be any bad karma. So I'm just basically saying this is what the Dhamma says. I'm not going to make any recommendation, you know, whether it's right or wrong. But this is my understanding of the Dhamma teaching. Yeah. Yes, you don't have. Yeah. Yeah. That would be unwholesome because there would be delusion. There would be delusion there. You have wrong livelihood, right? The livelihood is killing. Yeah? You may not have any hatred towards him. You may not do it out of greed, but there's some sort of delusion there. And this is the aspect of wrong livelihood on the Noble Eightfold Path, where you're trading in beings or killing beings. That's the problem there. Yeah. Well, precisely. And it's difficult. You know, sometimes life gets you into these very difficult situations where it's very hard to make, you don't know what to do, basically. It's very, very difficult. And I think that is why the precepts are essentially our guidelines, and you try your best to follow these precepts as far as you can. But sometimes there may be situations where you say, okay, in this case it's just so hard and so difficult that this case it might be, this case I can't see any other way out than breaking this particular precept. So, you have to be, obviously you have to be as careful as you possibly can and not do these things if there is any other solution whatsoever. But in certain circumstances, I think that, you can take these as guidelines, not as absolute. These are not commandments in the Christian sense, Okay. Well, the thing is that in that sort of situation, it depends on the pest exterminator's mindset, right? If the pest exterminator thinks, oh, it's a wonderful thing that there's a monastery, it's great, we need this monastery, we need all these Buddhist monks and nuns in the world because he has faith in the Dhamma or whatever. Of course, the more he thinks like that, the more he comes from a point of compassion, a point of trying to help, or wanting to help out. And the more he understands that what he's doing is not right, the more he has that view that this is not right, but I'll do it this time because it seems necessary. The more he comes from that sort of position, the less bad karma it is, because it's coming from compassion and wisdom. But if he thinks, these living beings are just a nuisance anyway, this is my job, I better exterminate them, and he sort of doesn't care about living beings whatsoever, then it's going to be more bad karma for him. So, that's the situation there. Of course, if a monk says that, can you please come and exterminate these things, that monk is making bad karma as well. That's part of it. But again, that monk would have to then decide, well, the situation, is so difficult and so hard in this particular case that we have no choice. He knows that what he's doing is bad karma. He will never do it again if he can avoid it. And he does it out of much compassion and wisdom as he possibly can. Again, that's the way you minimize that bad karma. So again, you have to take these things as guidelines. They are not absolute standards in Buddhism. And that is the beauty of it. So you the more you understand the Buddhist principles, the more you go back to ask yourself, what is my mind like? What is the mind state like? That is the most important thing here. That doesn't mean that you should easily overstep the five precepts, because sometimes you can delude yourself into thinking your mind is really, in a good state, so I don't really have to keep them. That is also very dangerous. The reason why the Buddha laid down the five precepts in the first place is to give some clear guidelines in life. If the only guideline you have is kindness, it's very easy to delude yourself. But if you have some clear guidelines, it's much easier to stick to those rules than if you don't have any clear guidelines. Yeah. Yes, sir. Okay, yeah, that's true. The question is, there was one of the disciples of the Buddha committed suicide, he became an arahant. That's correct. There's actually another case as well, another disciple of the Buddha who was an arahant, and he committed suicide while he was an arahant. And in those cases, the Buddha said, particularly with the one who already was an arahant, he said that he wasn't blameworthy because he was already liberated. His mind was already freed. There was no blame there. So for an arahant, you can imagine that he has this body left. The body, in this case, he was very, very ill. The body was falling apart. He didn't know, he probably felt it wasn't any use anymore in the world. An arahant's only purpose in life is basically to teach or to be an example to others, to somebody who can inspire other people. At that point, he probably felt there's no point. Why should I bear up with all this pain in the body if there's no point to my life anymore? I might as well end this life. So the point there, I think, is that, and this is another reason why I think that euthanasia might not be bad karma in certain circumstances. Because here is somebody killing themselves. And an arahant is obviously completely incapable of doing something unwholesome. He's completely incapable of acting from desire, from hate, or from delusion. So because of that, it was obviously, the suicide that he committed was obviously a wholesome act. He did it out of compassion for himself, basically. Realizing this is stupid to continue living in this way. So, and the other one that you mentioned is the one who actually seemed to become an arahant at the moment he committed suicide. Again, that was obviously somebody who was very advanced in the spiritual practice. And the point is that he, at the moment of death, is usually a very good time to reflect on the Dhamma, because, you know, this is a time I have to give everything up. I can't keep holding on to things. It's a very powerful time to develop insight into reality. And that's why he, because he obviously, again, he didn't do it from a bad motivation, he did it from a good motivation, he was able to use his own suicide to develop insight and actually, you know, become an arahat at that point. It was quite remarkable. Yeah. Thanks. Yes? Oh yeah, for sure. Oh yeah, that's great. Of course, yeah, that's a very good thing to do. And that is the opposite here of killing. Yeah. So it's like coming from compassion instead, coming from compassion and loving kindness for the world. Yeah. So, and this is a very important principle, that all of these kind of negative things that you read about, and you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that, you have lists of 5 precepts, 8 precepts, 10 courses of unwholesome action. These are the negative side. But then you have the positive side. Do something good, do something positive in the world. Yes, indeed. Yeah. Okay, so it's always an interesting topic, this thing about euthanasia, because it's obviously controversial, and it's often very difficult to know exactly what is the kind of what is ultimately right in these sort of circumstances. Okay, so that is the not to kill living beings, and then the next one is taking what is not given is unwholesome. Abstention from taking what is not given is wholesome. This is obviously just stealing. Misconduct in sensual pleasures is unwholesome. Abstention from misconduct in sensual pleasures is wholesome. This just refers to avoiding sexual contact with people, who, you know, with the wrong kind of persons, basically. False speech and lying, in other words, is unwholesome. Abstention from lying is wholesome. Malicious speech is unwholesome. Abstention from malicious speech is wholesome. Malicious speech here refers to dividing people. So, for example, if you have heard something somewhere, and you go to somebody else and say, and you use that what you heard somewhere else to divide people apart, to make trouble between people, then that is malicious speech. And this, I think, would even include talking negative about somebody to somebody else, because you are, by doing that, you're already creating some sort of division there, or at least potentially creating that division. And the opposite of malicious speech is speech which unifies people, brings people together, which brings harmony between people. Harsh speech is unwholesome. Abstention from harsh speech is unwholesome. Opposite of harsh speech is like gentle speech, speech which goes to the heart, speech which is loved by many people, which people want to hear. This is the right type of speech in this case. Gossip is unwholesome. Abstention from gossip is unwholesome. I'm not sure if gossip is the best possible translation for this, because the actual what this means, what this refers to, is actually idle talk, talk which doesn't really have any meaning to it. That's actually what this refers to. My understanding of the word gossip is more to do with talking about other people, but this actually refers to any kind of idle chatter. So this is the, again, it's important also to realize that there is a scaling here in these kind of things. So, for example, there's 4 types of unwholesome speech mentioned here. The worst one is lying, and the least bad one is what is called gossip here, or idle chatter. So you don't have to be, it's not as bad to talk too much as it is to lie or to literally be harsh or malicious in your speech. It's also much more difficult, obviously, to give up this idle chatter here. Okay, covetousness is unwholesome. Uncovetousness is wholesome. Covetousness here quite literally means covetousness. It means desiring other people's property. Ill will is unwholesome. Non-ill will is unwholesome. Wrong view is unwholesome. Right view is wholesome. There's 2 types of right view and 2 types of, or 2 types of right view rather. And right view is the ordinary, what we call ordinary mundane right view, which we have before you become a stream mentor, an Arya in this world. And this is just things like believing or having a faith in the law of karma, having faith in the such things as rebirth, having faith that the Buddha was enlightened, that there are beings in the world which are enlightened. This is part of right view. That is, I think, the essential aspect of right view. And then, of course, there is the full right view, which you gain when you become a stream entry, when you actually see the Dhamma for yourself and you understand the Four Noble Truths. So that is a full right view, because then you see precisely what the Buddha himself saw, and then you have no doubt anymore as to what this teaching is all about. Okay, so that is the 10 courses of unwholesome action. Again, remember that these are guidelines. It is possible to do bad things and not fall into these categories. Any time you divide things up like this, it is just like a schemata to help you classify things, to make it easy for you to live a moral life. But still, any kind of action which is motivated by hate, by desire, or by delusion is going to be bad karma, even if it doesn't fall into this scheme of 10 actions here. Then the Buddha goes on, when a bhikkhu has abandoned craving, cut it off at the root, made it like a palm stump, done away with it so that it is no longer subject to future arising, then that bhikkhu is an arahant with taints destroyed, one who has lived the holy life, done what had to be done, lay down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetter of being, and is completely liberated through final knowledge. So this is, the point here is that Vajragotha has asked the Buddha about the wholesome and the unwholesome, and this here obviously refers to the highest possible wholesomeness that you can gain in the Dhamma. You become fully enlightened. And that is what means here by abandoning craving. When all craving is abandoned, that is, means of course that you have become an arahant. Cut it off at the root, made it like a palm stump. The reason that they have this expression here is because a palm stump, once you chop the top of a palm, it doesn't grow again. It's dead, basically. And that's why, in the same way, craving cannot grow again once it has been abandoned completely. That's why it's no longer subject to future rising. His taints are destroyed. The taints here are, this Pali word is asavas. Asavas literally means something like outflowings. It's like the mind going out into the world. Three types of taints of asavas. There's the taints of sensual desire. The mind goes out into the world seeking pleasure in the world. There's a taint of being, of existence. You want to exist. So you go out into the world to satisfy your desire to exist. And finally, there is the taint of ignorance, or avidya, delusion, if you like, which is the root problem in the whole thing. And this is also drives you out into the world because of your ignorance. So once you have destroyed these taints, again, you are an arahant. You have lived the holy life. In other words, there's no more holy life to be lived. It says in the suttas, once you get to this stage, your desire to live the holy life subsides because you have actually reached the end of it. Done what had to be done, according to Buddhism, laid down the burden. There's no more burden of 5 khandhas of attaching. There's not even any burden of having to practice the path. Reached the true goal, reached Nibbana, destroyed the fetters of being. I wonder whether a better translation might be destroyed the fetters to being. In other words, being itself is not a fetter as I understand it. You're actually fettered to existence. You keep on roaming around in samsara, one existence after existence. You're fettered to samsara, to existence. And the fetters that you have are the craving inside your mind. Once you abandon that craving, you're not fettered to this existence anymore. You're not going around in samsara anymore. So I think a better translation might be fettered to existence. And finally, he is completely liberated through final knowledge. Final knowledge is the knowledge of the arahant. Anya is the Pali word for that. So that is the wholesome and the unwholesome. And now Vajragotha, the wanderer, speaks to the Buddha again. Apart from Master Gotama, is there any one bhikkhu who is Master Gotama's disciple who by realizing for himself with direct knowledge here and now enters upon and abides in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints? There are not only 100 vacha or 2 or 3 or 4 or 500, but far more bhikkhus, my disciples, who by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance of wisdom that is taintless with the destruction of the taints. So these, what Vachagotta is asking here, are there any other arahants apart from the Buddha himself? Is there anybody else who has realized these things apart from the Buddha? And it's a very good question, because obviously if you have a religion where one person's claimed to have seen the truth, but nobody else sees it, nobody else has understood it, then maybe you have grounds for having some doubt about that religion. If one person can understand something, you expect other people to understand it as well. If the Buddha had been the only one and nobody else was able to do it, there might have been grounds for doubt there, that this wasn't a proper path of practice after all, even though the Buddha claimed it was a proper path of practice. So the very fact that there are other people who can see the same thing, who can understand the same insights, obviously is a very important reason for having faith in Buddhism. The meaning of this here, who has realized by himself with direct knowledge here and now means like in this life before you die, enters upon and abides in the deliverance of mind, deliverance by wisdom. Deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, these are two slightly different ways of understanding what arahantship is all about. A deliverance of mind means that the mind has been delivered or freed, liberated from the hindrances, from craving once and for all. Once the mind is liberated from the hindrances, it means that you're able to enter samadhi, any kind of deep samadhi, almost at will, actually at will, just like that, whenever you want, pretty much. That is why it's called deliverance of mind, because deliverance of mind is a word used for samadhi throughout the suttas. So here you have achieved the kind of the ultimate deliverance of mind, because everything that hinders your ability to enter samadhi has been destroyed once and for all. So now you have the perfect ability to enter samadhi. Deliverance by wisdom, this means that you have understood the three characteristics of existence, impermanence, suffering and non-self, to the core, fully, absolutely, so that you have full understanding of what the Buddha taught. So you have been liberated through wisdom, absolutely liberated. Again, all defilements have been cut off because of that liberation through wisdom. There's two kind of complementary ways of understanding liberation from the Buddhist, in the Buddhist sense. One relating more to samadhi, to deep meditation, and the other one relating more to the understanding aspect of Buddhism, the wisdom aspect. Then Vachagotta goes on. Apart from Master Gotama and the bhikkhus, is there any one bhikkhuni, Master Gotama's disciple, who by realizing for herself with direct knowledge here and now, enters upon and abides in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints? There are not only 100, all the way up to 500, but far more bhikkhunis, my disciple, who by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. So here we get the bhikkhunis, the female disciples of the Buddha, into the picture. And it is quite interesting, in my opinion, because bhikkhuni, this idea of bhikkhunis is coming back very strongly again now around the world. In Sri Lanka, the bhikkhuni ordination in Sri Lanka died out, and it was dead for about 1,000 years. But now it's happening again very fast in Sri Lanka. There are lots of bhikkhunis again now in Sri Lanka. There are even some in Thailand, even the very few in Burma. And in the West also, it seems to be coming back very quickly. And it won't be long, I bet, that we have lots of bhikkhunis in Australia as well. So for that reason, it is interesting that the Buddha has to say, you know, that this actually crops up in the sutta. Because the point here that Vachagotta is making is that, well, if there weren't any female disciples who did have this realization, then the Dhamma wouldn't be the same. So the point here is that the very fact that there are bhikkhunis who realize these things, who become arahants, that gives, that emphasizes that the Dhamma is working properly, that there are these female disciples. So that is, of course, in a sense, a an encouragement for the idea of having bhikkhuni ordination in the West. It's appropriate to have that because the Dhamma is more fulfilled, it's more complete if we have bhikkhunis as well, not just bhikkhus. So for that reason, I think it's quite good to support the idea of bhikkhuni ordination. To do it well, do it properly, and then we can have the fourfold assembly of people, the bhikkhunis, the bhikkhus, laymen, laywomen, Buddhists, and then the Dhamma is much more complete in that way. Then Vajragotta continues, apart from Master Gotama and the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, is there any one man lay follower, Master Gotama's disciple, clothed in white, leading a life of celibacy, who, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, will reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world? There are not only 100, all up to 500, but far more men lay followers, my disciples, clothed in white, leading lives of celibacy, who, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, will reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. And then Vajragotta asked the same thing. I'll stop there actually, because there's something else. So these people, these lay disciples who wear white and who are celibate and who have abandoned the five fetters, these are people known as anagamis, non-returners. The reason they're called non-returners is actually stated here in the text, is because they never return from that world. They attain the final nibbana in that state where they get reborn. They destroy, the reason for that is because they have destroyed the five lower fetters. The five lower fetters includes all sensual desire, it includes all ill will. So it is a very, very high attainment. It's a last attainment before you become fully enlightened arahant. So at that time, the Buddha says there were large numbers of these lay disciples who had destroyed the five lower fetters, people who were almost arahants. It's interesting here, you will note that the sutta does not say that there are lay disciples who are arahants. And I think this is seems to be the view throughout the sutta, that it is impossible to actually live as a lay person and be an arahant. One of the things that an arahant is not supposed to be able to do is to store things up like people do in the household life, to have like stores of things. So essentially, it seems to be impossible to live the household life and be an arahant. The most praised lay disciples of the Buddha were always anagamis, non-returners. And they were the ones who had the highest wisdom among the lay disciples. It actually says in one sutta that was prior to here, it says that it is impossible to become an arahant, fully enlightened, without giving up, it says, the fetter of householdership. In other words, you have to give up this fetter. It's obviously a mental thing, first of all, but once you give up that mental thing, it is impossible then to go back to the household life again. So what you will see sometimes in the suttas, you will see that there are lay disciples who do gain arahantship, and of course, after they have gained that, they cannot go back again, so they then become monastics, and they continue their life as arahants. Or you have lay disciples who become arahants and then they die straight afterwards. And this, I think, goes back to this, what often happens, you can see this also in the suttas, that on the deathbed is always a good time to gain profound insights because you have to give up things. On the die, you realize, I can't hold on to things anymore. It becomes a very powerful lesson in giving up and abandoning things because you're dying anyway. So that's always one of the most powerful times to gain deep insights. That's why it is possible then to become an arahat on the deathbed, particularly if you already are an anagami beforehand, obviously. Otherwise, it's very hard. Okay, so we move on. So that is the lay disciples who have given up five fetters. When Vajragotta then goes on, apart from Master Gotama, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, the men lay followers clothed in white, leading lives of celibacy, is there any one man lay follower, Master Gotama's disciple, clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures, who carries out his instruction, responds to his advice, has gone beyond doubt, become free from perplexity, gained intrepidity, and become independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. There are not only 100 or 500, but far more men lay followers, my disciples, clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures, who carry out my instruction, respond to my advice, have gone beyond doubt, become free from perplexity, gained intrepidity, and become independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. So these people here, these are the screen mentors and the once returners that you're talking about here. So these are the Aryas which have not yet abandoned all the five lower fetters. And that is why they are able to enjoy, that's why it says here they enjoy sensual pleasures, because they haven't yet abandoned the fetter of a sensual desire. That's only when you become an anagama you abandon that. So these are still able to enjoy sensual pleasures. And you will see the description of this person here. Description is one who carries out his instruction, responds to his advice. Why is this mentioned in this way? Well, obviously the reason is, once you understand the Dhamma, you understand what it's all about, you take the Buddha as a teacher 100%, because you understand that the Buddha is enlightened. This is one of the understandings when you see this Dhamma for yourself. The Buddha must have been enlightened, otherwise he wouldn't have been able to teach this to me in this way. And of course, once you know that with absolute certainty, then you carry out his instruction and you respond to his advice. He has gone beyond doubt, become free from perplexity, because he has seen the Dhamma for himself. He's a ditti patto, one attained to view. Attained to view means you have seen these things 100%. There's no doubt anymore. Gained intrepidity, you are unshakable. There's a nice somewhere in the suttas where it says that if somebody argues with a screen mentor, it's impossible that he should feel in any way threatened by that argument, no matter how strong it is. Because he has seen it for himself. There is no argument anymore. So he cannot feel stirred up at all by external arguments. He has become independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. You know the Dhamma, you don't really need anybody else anymore. Nobody can argue with you. You're able to practice on your own because you have seen this for yourself. Of course, he can still benefit from teachings, but he is ultimately independent at this stage. Okay, so that's the screen mentor and the once returner. And then the Buddha says the same thing for the lay women in exactly the same terms. The lay women who have abandoned five fetters, and then the lay women who have also gone beyond doubt and beyond perplexity. So exactly the same thing for the lay women as for the lay men. Again, you can see here that the fourfold assembly, lay women, lay men, bhikkhunis and bhikkhus, they all have to be part of this Buddhist teaching before it becomes complete. This seems to be the message here in this sutta. And again, the Buddha says there are lots and lots of these lay women, just as there are of the other ones. Then Vajragata says, Master Gotama, this is on paragraph 13 now, page 493. Master Gotama, if only Master Gotama were accomplished in this Dhamma, but no bhikkhu were accomplished, then this holy life would be deficient in that respect. But because Master Gotama and bhikkhus are accomplished in this Dhamma, this holy life is thus complete in that respect. If only Master Gotama and bhikkhus were accomplished in the Dhamma, but no bhikkhunis were accomplished, then this holy life would be deficient in that respect. But because Master Gotama, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis are accomplished in this Dhamma, this holy life is thus complete in that respect. And in this way, he goes on through all the categories that we saw before, the lay men, the lay women who have become anagamis, and the lay men and lay women who are stream mentors and once returners. And in each case, he says the same thing. It's because of this that this Dhamma is, this holy life is complete. It's only complete because there are all these categories there. It's complete in that respect. Okay, so then we come to paragraph 14, page 599. Vajragata continues, just as the river Ganges inclines towards the sea, slopes towards the sea, flows towards the sea, and merges with the sea, So too, Master Gotama's assembly with its homeless ones and its householders inclines towards Nibbana, slopes towards Nibbana, flows towards Nibbana, and merges with Nibbana. In other words, all these people who are Aryas, they are going towards Nibbana. They have, in a sense, they have no choice anymore. It's now heading for Nibbana, no matter what. You wouldn't really want to have a choice anyway, because this is supposed to be the highest happiness in Buddhism. So of course you want to go in that direction. It's also interesting here, you see here, it is called Master Gotama's Assembly, because these four categories, bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, lay women and lay men, these are the four assemblies of Buddhism. It's not, sometimes we talk about the fourfold Sangha, but the fourfold Sangha is not, the Sangha in scripture is always the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. And if you take in the lay men and lay women, it's called the fourfold assembly. Sometimes today, if you read Buddhist magazines or you read certain people, they will talk about the Sangha as if it also incorporates the lay community, but that is not the way the Buddha used the word. Then Vajragotta continues, "Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama. Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. I would receive the going forth under Master Gotama. I would receive the full admission." And I find this is quite beautiful, this little paragraph here, because it shows you what he's saying here is how the Dhamma has been obscured in his life beforehand, and now it becomes clear. It's like turning upright what had been overthrown. And this, in a sense, it harks back to this idea in Buddhism of the vipalasas, that we see the world in a distorted way. We don't actually see the world often. We see things completely upside down in the world. And because we see things upside down, of course, that's what the whole meaning of delusion. And the Buddha said in the suttas that we see what is suffering. We regard it as happiness. We see it completely upside down. We see what is impermanent as permanent. Again, it's upside down. We see what is non-self as self. It's upside down. So here the Buddha is turning it up, the right way up. Suddenly, he obviously has understood what real suffering is. He understands all these other factors here. He reveals what was hidden. Because you're ignorant, you can't see properly, the truth is hidden from you. So you bring the truth forth into the light. You show the way to one who was lost. If you're practicing the Eightfold Path, then you're going the right direction. If you don't practice the Eightfold Path, you're not really going in a direction at all. Or you might even be going in the wrong direction. You might be going in a negative way, which leads to suffering in the future. So again, this is about showing the right way to somebody. Holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. Again, the idea of wisdom in Buddhism is very often talked about as light. Beforehand you are in the darkness because you don't understand the world properly. You don't see things the way they actually are. So you are in a kind of darkness in your life. You cannot see things. So when you actually see things properly, just as when you turn the light on in a room, in the same way, that is the simile which is being used here. And then he says, I would receive the going forth and the full admission. The going forth is the pabbaja. The pabbaja is becoming a novice. And the full admission here is the upasampada, when you become a full bhikkhu or a full bhikkhuni here. Then the Buddha replies, Vatsa, one who formerly belonged to another sect and desires the going forth and the full admission in this dhamma and discipline, lives on probation for 4 months. At the end of 4 months, if the bhikkhus are satisfied with him, they give him the going forth and the full admission to the bhikkhus state. But I recognize individual differences in this matter. Venerable sir, if those who formerly belong to another sect and desire the going forth and the full admission in this dhamma and discipline live on probation for 4 months, and if at the end of 4 months the bhikkhus being satisfied with them give them the going forth and the full admission to the bhikkhu state, then I will live on probation for 4 years. At the end of 4 years, if the bhikkhus are satisfied with me, let them give me the going forth and a full admission to the bhikkhu's state. So the point here, I think, is simply that if you belong to another sect beforehand, you have to make sure that this person has understood properly what Buddhism is about, that they have understood what right view is according to Buddhism, before you can actually ordain them. To ordain somebody who has the wrong kind of view according to Buddhism would just mean all kind of trouble, both for that person and also for the Sangha themselves. So you want to make sure that they really have grasped what Buddhism is about, because it's very likely to be very, very different from what they were used to beforehand. And the Buddha says, but I recognize individual differences. In other words, the Buddha, he looks at somebody, and of course if he sees that they are ready and that they have special abilities, he will often maybe waive that period of probation. And then Vajragupta, in his reply, he says, he shows how keen he is to become a monk by saying, I'll be happy to stay on probation for 4 years. All I'm really interested in is being able to become a monk so I can practice this Dhamma properly. Then the wanderer Vajragupta received the going forth under the Blessed One, and he received the full admission. Not long after his full admission, a half month after his full admission, the Venerable Vajragupta went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, I have attained whatever can be attained by the knowledge of a disciple in higher training. By the true knowledge of a disciple in higher training, let the Blessed One teach me the Dhamma further. A disciple in higher training, the Pali word is a seka. Seka literally means one's a person who trains. And anybody who trains is essentially somebody who hasn't attained arahantship yet. When you become an arahant, you're no longer training, because you reach the end of the path of training. So an arahant is called an aseka. A is a negative prefix, a non-trainer, somebody who does not train, because you finished your training. Yeah? So if when he says here that he has attained whatever can be attained by the knowledge of a disciple in higher training, it essentially means that he is at the step before becoming full arahant. He is essentially a non-returner at this stage. He's almost got there, but not quite. And now he's asking the Buddha, please teach me the very last step so I can become fully enlightened arahant. The Buddha replies, in that case, Vatsa, develop further two things, serenity and insight. When these two things, serenity and insight, are developed further, they will lead to the penetration of many elements. So he is telling him to develop serenity and insight. These two words is samatha and vipassana. And these two words are very often used together in the Pali Canon. You see them a lot together here. Because essentially these are the two crucial qualities that we always want to develop in our minds. Serenity being the peace, the calm, the insight being the understanding. These are the two foundation pillars for developing the mind. And they always work together, because the more peaceful you are, the more powerful the mind is, the easier it is to understand, to have insight. The more insight you have, what happens when you have insight? When you have insight, you let go of things. You let go of craving, of attachment to the world. Because you let go of craving attachment, it's much easier to have serenity, to have peace and calm. So these two things revolve around each other. One supports the other one supports the one. So they go together like this. And these are the two things that we want to develop the mind in. This serenity is interesting, because at the beginning of the path of serenity, initially you have to abandon the five hindrances to get proper samadhi. But after you have abandoned the five hindrances, the serenity doesn't stop there. It goes beyond that. And beyond that, what you are developing at that point is the seven bhojangas, the seven factors of enlightenment. And as you go through the stages of the jhanas, for example, you have already abandoned the hindrances a long time ago. What you're doing is strengthening these bhojangas, the factors of enlightenment, with each jhana as you go up these jhanas. And with the fourth jhana, that's when you reach the maximum strength of the bhojangas. The bhojangas are the factors of enlightenment. They are beginning with sati, mindfulness. Then you have Dhamma Vichaya, which is like investigation of the Dhamma. This is the wisdom aspect. Then you have energy, piti, either piti or energy, and the next one is an either piti or energy. It's rapture, and then the energy. I think it's energy first, then piti, then tranquility, pasaddi, then samadhi, and then finally equanimity. And equanimity reaches its highest potential when you attain the fourth jhana. So that's when you reach the highest potential of the seven factors of enlightenment. So this is the meaning of serenity here, all the way up to the fourth jhana, essentially. So when you do this, you will penetrate many elements. And the elements that are talked about next here are what is often called the six iddhis, the six spiritual powers. And they include here all the marvelous kind of powers. I'll read through them fairly quickly because we've already been on going on for almost an hour. So the first one of these iddhis is as follows. To the extent that you may wish, may I wield the various kinds of supernormal power. Having been one, may I become many. Having been many, may I become one. May I appear and vanish. May I go unhindered through a wall, through an enclosure, through a mountain, as though through space. May I dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. May I walk on water without sinking as though it were earth. Seated cross-legged, may I travel in space like a bird. With my hand, may I touch and stroke the moon and sun, so powerful and mighty. May I wield bodily mastery even as far as the Brahma world. You will attain the ability to witness any aspect therein, there being a suitable basis. So all of these things you're supposed to be able to do if you practice properly. There being a suitable basis, this means that you have done enough practice to be able to attain this. Usually means attaining the fourth jhana. That is when you have the mind is powerful enough to be able to do these kind of things. Able to witness any aspect therein. I think all that means is just that you can, any of these things, you can basically choose whichever one you want to do. You can choose it, you can do it. Any of these aspects you can actually, should be able to do after you develop the mind in this way. Yes, sir. I think it actually relates to the physical body, because other people will see you going through a mountain, right? So they will see you disappearing into the mountain. It is. Yeah, it's true. So I think it's a certain way in which the mind affects the body in a certain way. So it enables the body to do this kind of things. So it's a use of the mental power to change the body in such a way that it can actually do this kind of things. The way it says, the way you're supposed to do this, as I understand it, is that you use what is called the kasina meditations in the suttas. Kasinas are the fire element, the fire kasina, the earth kasina, the water kasina, the air kasina. And by developing these kasinas, you can then affect the body using these kasinas to change the constitution of the body. So you can do things like use the earth kasina on a body of water to make it possible to walk on that body of water. You can maybe use the air kasina to affect the constitution of a mountain so you can actually walk through it. This kind of trick apparently is what you have. What can you do to do it? I don't know. I must admit, this is quite obscure. I constantly say I know anybody who can do these kind of things. So I haven't really been able to ask anybody. But sometimes you hear about people who claim to be able to do these kind of things. I'm not sure. It's uncertain. Yeah. Okay. So then, that's the first kind of psychic power. The next one is, to the extent that you may wish, may I, with a divine ear element, which is purified and surpasses the human, hear both kinds of sounds, the divine and the human, those that are far as well as near, you will attain the ability to witness any aspect therein, there being a suitable basis. So, and this sometimes you can see in the suttas, you can see the Buddha hearing somebody far away, for example, hearing the devas, or even hearing somebody's thought that comes up next. So this is what is being talked about here. To the extent that you may wish, may I understand the minds of other beings, of other persons, having encompassed them with my own mind. May I understand a mind affected by lust as affected by lust, and a mind unaffected by lust as unaffected by lust. May I understand a mind affected by hate as affected by hate, and a mind unaffected by hate as unaffected by hate. May I understand a mind affected by delusion as affected by delusion, and a mind unaffected by delusion as unaffected by delusion. May I understand a contracted mind as a contracted mind, and a distracted mind as distracted. May I understand an exalted mind as exalted, and an unexalted mind as unexalted. May I understand a surpassed mind as surpassed, and an unsurpassed mind as unsurpassed. May I understand a concentrated mind as concentrated, and an unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated. May I understand a liberated mind as liberated, and an unliberated mind as unliberated. You will attain the ability to witness any aspect therein, there being a suitable basis. So this is just that you are able to understand somebody else's mind. You can see exactly what defilements are there or what defilements are missing in that mind. So a few of these things, let's maybe comment on some of them. A contracted mind, this is usually a word for sloth and torpor. Your mind is just like feels stiff and contracted inside. A distracted mind is usually a word for restlessness. So you understand that somebody is restless, the mind is wandering all over the place. An exalted mind here, the word Pali word is mahagata. It means literally gone great. And this is usually a reference to the mind in the Brahma Viharas, in metta, compassion, and these states. Surpassed mind and unsurpassed mind. Unsurpassed again is usually a reference to samadhi, as is the next term, which is concentrated. And even liberated mind here seems to be a reference here to liberation in terms of liberation from the five hindrances. Probably again a reference to samadhi, to concentration, to meditation. Okay, then so these three psychic special powers I've just been talking about now, these are not very important on the Buddhist path because they're not really related to the path as such. You don't need these things to be able to attain nirvana. These are like additional spiritual powers that you can have. And the Buddha, in one other sutta, talked about the danger in these kind of spiritual powers. And the danger is that if you put too much emphasis on these things, if you teach too much about these things, then those people who have enough faith, they will say, oh yeah, that makes sense. I can understand that might be possible. But those people who don't have enough faith, they will say, oh yeah, it's just some kind of magic trick, that you're using some kind of charm or some kind of trick to be able to do this. And for that reason, these things are not, can be dangerous. They're not so important. And that's why sometimes they are not so emphasized in the Buddha's teaching. They're not such an integral part of the path. They're a bit more of a side issue. But the next three powers which come up next here, which is the memory of past lives, the understanding of the laws of karma, and the final destruction of all defilements, well, these are the three spiritual powers which are very important, because these are completely fundamental to the Buddhist teachings. So this is what we get to now. So the next spiritual power here, the Buddha goes on, to the extent that you may wish, may I recollect my manifold past life, that is, there's a contraction in the text here. I'll go back to another sutta to get the full reading, because it's just nice to read it out. Yeah, he recollects manifold past lives. That is one birth, two births, three births, four births, five births, 10 births, 20 births, 30 births, 40 births, 50 births, 100 births, 1,000 births, 100,000 births. Many eons of world contraction, many eons of world expansion, many eons of world contraction and expansion. There I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment or my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term. and passing away from there, I reappeared elsewhere. And there too, actually there too is not really good, it's more like, and there I was so named of such a clan, with such an appearance, with such food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term, and passing away from there, I reappeared here, in other words, in the present life. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, he recollects his manifold past lives. So this is a recollection of past life. You can see this sort of recollection is a very detailed and clear recollection. It's a structured kind of recollection where you are able to see life after life in a sequence until you get to the present life. This is quite different. Sometimes you have people having nimittas, they have these things, pictures coming up in their mind, which sometimes they take to be a past life experience. And these things can be past life experiences. But the real recollection of past life is a structured recollection whereby you remember a sequence of events, birth, death, then rebirth, the events of that life, the death in that life, and then the rebirth into the next life until you get to the present life. That is the real recollection of past life according to the Buddha's teaching. It's a very structured kind of way of doing it. So with a nimitta which just flashes up in the mind, it's very difficult to know for sure exactly what you have remembered. But in this way here, it is a very clear sequence and you can see cause and effect going backwards or forwards all the way to the present life. There's no doubt anymore that this is the real thing. Then that is the first knowledge. And this is, of course, very important because this sort of knowledge is a foundation for attaining enlightenment afterwards. I'll speak briefly about that afterwards. Then the fifth kind of idi, of knowledge here, is the understanding of kamma. To the extent that you may wish, may I, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, here and now enter upon and abide... I'm missing a paragraph here. Yeah. May I, with a divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. He understands how beings pass on in accordance with their actions thus. These worthy beings, who are ill-conducted in body, speech and mind, revilers of the noble ones, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body, after death, have reappeared in a state of deprivation, in a bad destination, in perdition, in hell. But these worthy beings, who were well conducted in body, speech and mind, not revilers of noble ones, right in their views, giving effect to right view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body, after death, have reappeared in a good destination, in a heavenly world. Thus, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, he sees beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. And he understands how beings pass on in accordance to their actions. So in other words, he's here seeing the law of karma. He sees that good actions lead to good rebirth, bad actions lead to bad rebirth. And these two, you will find that when you read the suttas, things like the gradual training or how you ultimately attain full enlightenment, you generally find that these two iddhis, these two powers, are usually attained before you become fully enlightened. So why do you have to attain these things before you become fully enlightened? And it seems to me the reason is when you understand rebirth, you understand how terrible it is that you're faring up and down from one birth to another one, to one destination which is terrible, to another destination which is good, and it's completely out of your control. It's just accordance to the karma, and in one life you have no idea whether you're making good karma or bad karma because you're not a Buddhist and you have got wrong views, and it's just a whole mess that you are in, essentially. It looks frightening. It looks very, very scary. And this is why when you see this, that is when, for the first time, you really want to get out of this mess. You want to get out of samsara. And you want to free yourself from this whole cycle of birth and death. Sometimes you hear people say that the reason why people believe in rebirth is because it feels like kind of secure to believe in rebirth. Because you know you're going to exist again in the future. And I know that there are people, even Buddhist people, who say, I don't believe in rebirth because this is some kind of sop to sort of make you happy. You don't have to disappear after you die. You're going to keep living there. But, and it may be true, there may be certain Buddhists who believe in rebirth because it feels good and it gives them a kind of comfort in life. But if you really understand the Buddha's teachings, it's the opposite which is the case. It is rebirth which is frightening. It is rebirth which is dangerous. It is rebirth that you want to get rid of. And that is the reality of it. And that's why you have to take this teaching so seriously. Because if there is rebirth and you don't believe in it, well, you are, of course, going to be in big trouble in your future, in the future. Because something is going to happen which is not very nice. In fact, from a Buddhist point of view, it is the people who believe, who are materialists, who believe that everything is going to come to an end as you die, they are the ones who are wishful thinkers. It's a wishful thinking to think everything is going to come to an end, because that is the easy way out. If everything comes to an end when you die, there is no problem. There is no rebirth anymore. It's okay. So that is the wishful thinking, not the fact that there is rebirth. The fact that there is rebirth is one of the terrible disasters according to Buddhism. So having understood that there is rebirth and understood the mechanism that drives this rebirth, which is the law of karma, then you are really ready for full enlightenment because you have seen the mess you're in. Then comes the last part here. To the extent that you may wish, may I, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints, you will attain the ability to witness any aspect therein, there being a suitable basis. So this then is the destruction of the taints. This is a full enlightenment experience when you are able to turn away from samsara once and for all, because it is essentially just a place of suffering. There's no point in staying there. So this was a teaching the Buddha gave to Vajragotha, and then the Venerable Vajragotha, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One words, rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he departed. Keeping on the right here is just a polite way of acting in India in those days. Before long, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Vajragotha, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge here and now, entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. He directly knew, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. And the Venerable Vajragotha became one of the arahants. So you can see here that one of the characteristics of somebody who then becomes an arahant is that they dwell alone and withdrawn. In other words, in a secluded place, far away. I was talking about this a little bit on Friday, about the importance of seclusion in Buddhism. And here you see it right away, dwelling alone and withdrawn is a way of expressing the idea of seclusion, dwelling away from the city, from other people. Diligent, ardent, and resolute just means the energy, that you keep a constant energy, constant practice, to be able to realize these kind of things. And then when you do that, that's when you have a chance to realize here the full arahatship. And what do you know when you become an arahant? What you know is that birth has been destroyed, or birth has been ended, if you like. Holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There's no more coming to any state of being. In other words, there's no further existence beyond this. So that is the knowledge of the arahant. He knows that rebirth and future existences have come to an end. That's the knowledge he has. This is the one thing that he understands when that arahant becomes fully enlightened. So, we're coming to the end here. Now, on that occasion, a number of bhikkhus were going to see the Blessed One. The Venerable Vajragotha saw them coming in the distance. Seeing them, he went to them and asked them, "Where are the Venerable Ones going?" "We are going to see the Blessed One, friend." In that case, may the Venerable Ones pay homage in my name with the heads at the Blessed One's feet, saying, Venerable Sir, the Bhikkhu Vajragotta pays homage with his head at the Blessed One's feet. Then say, the Blessed One has been worshipped by me. The Sublime One has been worshipped by me. This has been worshipped by me, or has been respected by me, or has been esteemed by me, or something to that effect. Me is just a way of saying indirectly that I have become an arahant. I guess it was considered a bit crude just to say I am fully enlightened or whatever. So you would say it in an indirect way, not to sort of seem to boast or something. Yeah. So that's the meaning of those words. Yes, friend, those bhikkhus replied. Then they went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, they sat down at one side and told the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Vajragotta pays homage with his feet at the Blessed One's feet, with his head at the Blessed One's feet, and he says, the Blessed One has been worshipped by me, the Sublime One has been worshipped by me. Bhikkhus, replies the Buddha, having encompassed his mind with my own mind, I already knew of the Bhikkhu Vajragotta. The Bhikkhu Vajragotta has attained the threefold true knowledge and has great supernormal power and might. And the deity also told me this. The Bhikkhu Vajragotta has attained the threefold true knowledge and has great supernormal power and might. It is interesting here to note that the Buddha says not only has he encompass this with his own mind, but the deities have also told him this. And why is this included like this? Why this doubling up that he has encompassed it with his own? It sounds like it should be enough to say that he has encompassed it with his own mind. It seems to be irrelevant that certain devas or deities have also told him this. And the way I would understand this is that the Buddha is obviously not encompassing the mind of all the monks all the time, because it would take an enormous amount of energy to do that. So what I suspect what is going on here is that when somebody is becoming an arahant, maybe they have like a guardian deva, somebody looks after them or something like that, and that deva will then realize that this monk has become an arahant. He goes to the Buddha and says so. Then the Buddha checks it out for himself. Is it true? And then when he realizes it is true, then he is satisfied that that is the case. So that would be my, or maybe one understanding of why this is written in this particular way. Okay, so that is, we're coming to the very last sentence. That is what the Blessed One said. Those bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, any last questions or comments, anybody here? Okay, there is a general kind of, it happens in many different cultures, you have this idea of guardian deities, of a kind of angel which looks after you. And also you find that in the suttas as well, you find that if you have metta, for example, a lot of loving kindness, then you will be guarded by the deities, by the devas. So this seems to be a kind of general, almost like a folklore, which is also found in the suttas. So I think it to be probably quite likely this actually is what happens. You can actually, if you are a very virtuous person, a very good person, there will be deities who look after you and make sure that you are safe and sound, you don't do stupid things, and they will, help you out if you get into dangerous situations, for example. And this is what I think may be happening with Vajragotta. He had this deity looking after him. Yeah. Yes. Well, it's just that it's better not to have any kind of relationships. It's preferable, huh? But the point is, it's only a small thing, and that's why in the five precepts it's acceptable. The five precepts tells you the worst kind of things, the things that will really block you from making spiritual progress. If you break the five precepts, you're in big trouble for making spiritual progress. But having a relationship is only a small thing, and that's why it doesn't matter so much. You can go a long, long way on the path and have relationships. But ideally, it's even more virtuous. If you can't live a celibate life, it's even higher state of virtue. It says that in the suttas, that, you know, there is a comparison one place between a man who still had a relationship with his wife and one who didn't. The one who didn't was considered more virtuous than the other one. So it is a higher state, but it's not so important, and that's why it is not really mentioned in the suttas. It's not something which is going to make it impossible to make progress or anything like that. So it's all, everything in the Dhamma is always matters of degrees. Even essential thought, even a thought which seems quite innocent, is in a sense slightly bad. But it's a very small badness compared to many other things which are far, far worse. So it's all relative. That's basically where it comes in. True, and that's why, but you have to remember that the mind is very variable, right? You can, at one point in your life, you have no central thoughts, and then they come back again. You can go on retreat, and you can maybe have some very deep and very good meditation while you're on retreat, and then you come back, you lose that meditation, and centrality comes back again in the mind. So it goes up, it's very up and down. These things are not constant. And that's why you can make progress, even though they occasionally, or even quite often, are central thoughts in the mind. You can still make progress. You can still have deep meditation from time to time, as long as you're able to abandon them. But of course, as you practice in this way, and as you see that you are hindering your meditation by having sensual thoughts, the more sensual thoughts you have, the more you're hindering your meditation, the more you understand that, you see that by looking into your mind, the more you will incline away from that, right? So, but it's a natural process, not something you try to force onto yourself. You try to just, you go with the flow, and then you when you understand it, it becomes a natural thing to do. Huh? Yeah. Yes, sir. Is the eradication of, yeah. Oh no, the Bhujangas comes first. Because after you're fully enlightened, there's not very much incentive anymore to develop the Bhujangas. Usually once you become an Arahant, you're finished, you're done, you don't have any desire to practice the path anymore. And this is one of the things it says in the suttas, once you become an Arahant, the whole desire to develop yourself disappears. It becomes settled down because you're finished. So these things are what precipitates, as you say, the destruction of the taste. So you practice these things. The more powerful the Bhujangas are, the more likely it is that you will actually be able to destroy the taints. Yeah. Is that what you're asking? Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was the other way around.
It's both, right? It's a gradual process. You start off by being virtuous. And you go a long way, you don't eradicate anything by keeping the precepts. But by keeping the precepts, you are reducing the strength of these defilements. And then only when the defilements are completely suppressed in the mind, the Bhujangas are very powerful, then you can eradicate those defilements. The defilements can only be eradicated after they have been abandoned temporarily. Through precepts, through meditation. And then, when they have been abandoned, then you can have the sort of insight which actually eradicates them at the root. So it's a gradual thing here. It's a temporary abandonment. You use the temporary abandonment to eradicate completely here. Okay? Yeah. Yes? Yes, oh yeah, sure. Because the reason why you can't recall the past life is because your mind is very clear, right? It's extraordinarily clear. So somebody who has this kind of ability, he will sit down and he will just remember backwards. He will remember things that he had never remembered before because the mind is so powerful. And then you come to the point where maybe you were born, and then you can skip backwards into the previous life at a certain point. But this is the whole point here, is that the reason you can do this is because you have access to memories and things that you cannot access with the ordinary mind, which just isn't powerful enough. That's why you can do these remarkable things. Memory in the suttas is always correlated with mindfulness. So the more mindfulness you have, the more memory you have. It's also correlated with defilements. A person who has full of defilements and a lot of anger and ill will and desire, that hinders memory. So if you have a mind which is very, which doesn't have much defilements in it, you will tend to remember things very easily. Okay, well, that's quite a long one. Any last questions before we call it? Yeah. It's just the best thing to do is just to sort of you have to see for yourself, really. You know, you see what it does to your mind. You know, when you, I mean, I know sometimes we have like a video taking back to the monastery, just, you know, some kind of show which talks about rebirth or something like that, and we see it in the monastery here. And when I see that, I can feel how your mind gets, when you see something, like it was an Oprah Winfrey show that we had, which was about rebirth, which showed in the monastery because it was sort of interesting here. But when I see this kind of thing, I can just feel that your mind gets dragged out. It's sort of, you lose your sense of mindfulness very easily. And this is the kind of thing that you have to be aware of. The more you are aware of these things, the more natural it becomes to give these things up, because you feel that it just doesn't feel good. You lose a sense of centeredness. You lose a sense of mindfulness that you have. So this is really the right way of doing it. And then go on a retreat, you know, and see how your mind reacts to retreat. How pure, you know, what does it do? But don't sort of, you know, be too hard on yourself. Don't sort of cut out doing everything. I know that there are certain lay people in ordinary life who keep the 8 precepts, and I think that is very admirable to do that if you can keep the 8 precepts in daily life. But I think sometimes I see also lay people going too far, because the Buddha didn't say that we should keep 8 precepts in lay life. He said it's 5 precepts. And by trying to keep things like 8 precepts in lay life, you can damage your health, you know, not eating in the afternoon when you're very busy, you're doing all kinds of things. Maybe it can be a negative thing here. So you have to find that balance. You have to know what is right and not push yourself too far. The most important thing, as you know, the area where I really put the emphasis, if I were you, or any kind of lay life, is just to be a good person, be kind, be good-hearted. That is what really matters, you know. And if you find that your indulgence in sensuality somehow hinders you in being kind, it hinders you in being good, well, that is where you have to be careful, right? And this comes, you know, this can happen. I mean, for example, things like extramarital affairs, for example, when people have that, that is when the sense of sensuality gets in the way of morality. And that's where you have to be careful. So the most important thing is to, and there's so much work you can do in the area of virtue and morality. You know, speech is notoriously difficult to be, always speak rightly, right? It's very hard. And then, of course, there is the virtue of the mind, you know, to always think kind thoughts, not to get angry and all the things. There's a lot of work to do there before you have to be too concerned about sensuality. So don't be too worried about that, because it's a small fault compared to anger, for example. Anger is a much, much bigger fault, and that is one which is much more important to overcome. So I would, you know, put emphasis on kindness, put the emphasis on overcoming the really negative stuff. And then as you move along, you can start to maybe think more about the sensual desire, that sort of thing, later on, when you go on retreat, meditation retreat, and these sort of things.